Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. In this episode, I talk with Adam Sterling, the Assistant Dean for Executive Education and Revenue Generation at UC Berkeley School of Law and the Executive Director of the Berkeley Center for Law and Business. In this podcast, we talk about the Independent Director Initiative, a two-day program designed to train and help place individuals from backgrounds underrepresented in venture capital to serve as independent directors on the boards of venture-backed private companies. The inaugural cohort of the program was hosted on August 16th and 17th at Berkeley, and we recorded this episode last week on Friday, August 19th. We also discuss what makes the composition of venture-backed company boards so different and the fiduciary duties of directors in these companies, where the role of the independent director can be critical, particularly in a down-cycle economy where down rounds, recaps, or fire sales may be more prevalent. If you like the show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can find all the show notes on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com. Adam, it is so good to see you again. We were together early this week in the Independent Director Initiative. We'll talk a lot about that. But first of all, thank you very much for taking the time and talking to me in the Boardroom Governance Podcast.
Evan, it's a pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
All right. So let's dive into your personal and professional background. I always like to highlight the guests of this podcast. So why don't you tell us where you born, where you grew up, and we'll start from there and we'll get all the way to your current role at Berkeley.
Well, I grew up in Southern California and didn't go far. Went down to UC San Diego for college and transferred and finished at UCLA.
Okay. And then what did you do after college?
So I like to say I was a successful social entrepreneur and then later a failed tech entrepreneur. But when I was in college, this was the early 2000s, this was around the time the conflict, which later became a genocide in Darfur, Sudan, broke out. First time in U.S. history, actually, that the U.S. government declared an ongoing conflict to be genocide. My background, although we're not practicing, my family is Jewish and my grandma was a Holocaust survivor. So I've always lived with the kind of awareness of the Holocaust and genocide. And as a college student, when I learned about what was happening in Darfur, I joined with a few other classmates. And we started initially just advocating Congress. We organized a letter writing campaign on campus, but eventually, we connected with some folks that were active in the apartheid divestment movement and ultimately developed a new model of targeted divestment, which asked investors to engage with companies operating in Sudan and to put pressure on the Sudanese government. And long story short, we lobbied the University of California to divest its holdings in certain companies, wrote legislation for the state of California. And then ultimately 25 other states, we passed federal legislation and it became a full-time job. We received a really generous grant and I did that for a number of years, headquartered in Washington, D.C. before I went to grad school.
Wow. I knew very little of that. So I'm glad I asked the question. You see, you always discover new things, some of them very relevant for the current environment of corporate governance, institutional investors, divestments, ESG, right? There's a lot of that we can discuss later on. But then you decide to go to law school, have a JD, MBA. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I didn't know. I had taken the LSAT before I got involved in the social justice work and but knew I wanted to go back to grad school. But at that point, when I was applying, wasn't sure I wanted to be a lawyer. I also don't hate taking standardized tests. And so I had some free time. I studied for and took the GMAT, did well enough that I felt confident applying also to business school. So I did the joint degree. And then when I was at Berkeley, I really kind of fell in love with the startup tech scene. I during business school, tried to start my own startup, tech startup. And that's where I learned it doesn't matter how good your idea is. If you don't have a good team and a good execution, you're not going to go anywhere. So we failed to raise adequate funding to move forward. And then ultimately, when I graduated, I instead of starting a company, I supported other founders and practiced law in the venture space, supporting, you know, startups and VC funds.
Yeah. So after law school and business school, you went to Gunderson, a preeminent law firm. How was that practice?
You know, it was good. I still have a lot of close friends there, and I thought the work was interesting. I think, you know, it only lasted a few years, and the challenge for me was, you know, I didn't want to wait in line 10, 15 years to make partner and to really have an influence on the business. I wanted to really lead and manage, and I learned a lot, but then had the opportunity to return to Berkeley and lead the Business Law Center. The Berkeley had brought on some new exciting faculty members, and I was recruited, and I said yes, and found myself back on campus.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's true that some lawyers tend to have more of a business inclination, and when you practice law, you realize that you actually at the call and beck of the business people, and you're not in the driving seat. And some temperament, sometimes, you know, there's a lot of discussion. A lot of people ask me whether they should get a JD or MBA, and it's interesting your experience on both ends, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. My advice for those folks is you have to be open to kind of creativity. I think unfortunately there aren't employers that specifically target JD MBAs. There are employers that target JDs, employers that target MBAs. And because of that, it's not always the best investment from a cost benefit analysis, but I think it's served me well in my kind of unique career. And I loved grad school, so I don't regret having an extra year.
So after you've been about 7 years at your current role, but now you're an assistant dean in executive education, which I think is really interesting, particularly from a law school perspective, right? Executive education historically has been very strong from business schools, and you've done a tremendous job at Berkeley at the Center for Business Law. Tell us a little bit about that and what entails your new role, because for some people, maybe they don't know how law schools operate and all the great executive education and programs that you're putting together from Berkeley.
Well, thanks, Evan. And you're correct that historically, most executive education has been driven by the business schools, and that's the case also at Berkeley. It started, so I had a client when I practiced law, 500 startups. And they're a global VC fund, probably one of the most active VC funds in the world. And you know, they work with a lot of kind of emerging VCs, a lot of angel investors, early stage investors around the globe. And one of the things that we found was that, you know, with the exception of a few published works, certainly, you know, Brad Feld and Jason Mendelsohn's venture deal, Scott Cooper's book, Secrets of Sand Hill Road, there isn't much out there that kind of teaches venture has a kind of asset class, you know, the legal, financial, and operational aspects of the business. And so through the center, the Business Law Center, we started a program with 500 startups called VC Deal Camp, where we spent a week with aspiring VCs at training them on the basics, the fundamentals of venture finance. It was quite successful. And so my dean at that time said, you know, Adam, I think it would be really great if we did more in executive ed, and maybe your center could kind of incubate executive education with the idea that eventually it would become its own department at the law school. And so that's what's happened. You know, over the past few years, we've developed additional courses, programs, you know, more in venture finance, programs in ESG and sustainability. We have a great leadership course called Leadership in the Legal Profession. And then just this year, executive education has become its own department at Berkeley Law. And with that, I received the new title.
Yeah. And I have to say, it's excellent. I spent quite a bit of time at Stanford, and I looked at the growth of Berkeley, and it's excellent, the stage in which you are. And it takes us to your latest program, the Independent Director Initiative, which just happened this week. Let's talk about the Independent Director Initiative. You know, what is it and why was it created?
Well, first, Evan, let me say thank you for your role in it. And so not only were you an instructor, you were instrumental in, I think, both inspiring and developing this program. I know a lot of what we have built took inspiration from your work at Stanford. So thanks for that. And thanks for your involvement in what we did this week. You know, I'll say that the inspiration actually dates back to my work as a junior attorney at Gunderson Dettmer. You know, I did, even in just a few years, I probably helped lead hundreds of venture financings. And each one of those deals, you're more or less negotiating the same documents. And one of those documents is the voting agreement. And one of the things that the voting agreement does is it kind of stipulates who is responsible or who has the power to nominate certain directors. And that is usually split amongst the company, which usually has its founders serving as directors, and then the venture capital funds, which usually have their investment partners serving as directors. But in almost all of those financings, you often see an additional board seat being created. In venture terminology, it's known as the mutual director seat, and that's what we are referring as the independent director seat, which I think is the terminology used in more mature and public companies. But unlike these other seats, which in addition to stipulating who has the power to nominate those seats, also actually names the individual to take that seat, I noticed that I almost never saw an individual named as the mutual director. And I always thought this was strange, right? We went through the effort of actually creating this seat, which I we can discuss, I think has important governance responsibilities, but we actually never saw anyone appointed. We actually, working with Omni, which is a great organization that does a lot of back office support for VC funds, we've learned that, you know, in fact, something like 50% of all venture-backed companies following their financings have a vacant board seat. This is quite common. And so I was always struck by that. Years later, I've also always been struck by the lack of diversity and representation on you know, venture-backed boards. And so, you know, this is an idea that's been brewing for a while. And I thought, well, if we were able to attract a group of executives and leaders from communities underrepresented in Silicon Valley, those folks would be just obvious candidates to serve as independent directors on these boards. And then more recently, we can discuss that. I actually think the kind of economic turmoil, the challenging fundraising environment for Silicon Valley actually makes this opportunity more interesting and more urgent.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the lessons to me through the years, right? Like, you and I have lived here in Silicon Valley for a long time. I focused a lot on corporate governance. And one of the distinctions is that people tend to know and understand a lot of what happens in public boards. Yep. But what happens in private venture-backed boards is almost a black box, right? Unless you read Scott Cooper's book or maybe Brad Feld's, you know, and unless you practice in this area, you wouldn't know. So most of the U.S. is almost clueless on how this operates. And when you look at composition of boards, it's diametrically different, right? Because in public boards, particularly large public boards, mostly 85% of the directors are independent, plus the CEO. But when you come to a Silicon Valley venture-backed board, you have one or two founders, you have one or two investors. As the investors invest more, they get more board seats. And very few, if any, independent directors. Typically, when you approach going public, that's when they start putting these independent directors. And so, you know, what's interesting is now, slowly, as private companies are getting more relevant, as we have these unicorns, I think people need to understand this type of governance, which is very different. There's no separation of ownership control, these typical agency costs that we have. And so it's really interesting that I think for most people, this is not something they encounter. There's not much litigation that goes on. There is some that is very specific, and that in the program that we had was very highlighted as a very famous case, the Trados case from 2013, which establishes very clearly what are the duties of directors and what are the distinctions among the different classes of directors, right? So that's kind of to level set, because I don't know about you, Adam, but when I talk about corporate governance, and I talk a lot in different places, right? Like in Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. but also around the US or internationally, yep. I find that people don't really know because it's a very specific area. And so this program is really interesting, in part because you did have a lot of people from outside Silicon Valley. There were people actually from outside the US. So why don't you, you know, first of all, I want to ask you a question specific on this. The program was hosted by VC University. Why don't you talk a little bit about VC University, which maybe kind of the underlying or holding, you know, concept where this falls into?
Yeah. Well, I would just say, I think you're spot on as far as the issues or the lack of transparency around VC back boards and what they do. So that's an important point. But VC University, to your question, was actually the evolution of our executive education program in venture capital. So VC University is a partnership that Berkeley has with the National Venture Capital Association and Venture Forward, which is their nonprofit that's focused on democratizing access to venture capital. And it's basically an educational platform for aspiring and emerging venture capitalists. We each cohort, we provide full scholarships to about 25% of each cohort. So there's also a focus on equity and inclusion in venture. And so that just seemed like a natural platform for the Independent Director Initiative because a lot of the overlapping goals of that program. But then I think a really cool part of the Independent Director Initiative was we were able to build a much bigger coalition of universities. So in addition to Berkeley, Hastings, your institution was one of the partners, your previous institution, Stanford was a partner, as well as Columbia, Penn, and a number of others.
Which we have to say, it's a remarkable group, right? Like, I don't think there's ever been a coalition of universities putting together a program like this. And when we had the program, I mean, we had the who's who on corporate law teaching all of this, and that was remarkable. But not only do you have like all these academic partners, there were also all these organizational partners.
Yeah.
And why don't you talk about them? And Ascend, Black VC, the Board List, Bolster, Corporate Directors Forum, the Fourth Floor, the Historically Black Colleges and Universities, Him for Her, LCDA, which is the Latino Corporate Director Association, the National Black MBA Association, NVCA, Nextwork, Venture Forward. I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah, these are all incredible organizations that I've had the privilege of working with over the years. But my kind of inspiration here was, you know, you and your viewers likely know, our listeners, there's a lot of organizations out there that do training and placement programs for directors or are aspiring directors. And my approach to this was I wanted this to be complementary. And I think it was because a lot of the participants in the program came from these organizations. And then I think our focus on the independent director role in venture-backed boards was particularly unique. I still to this day have not found a program that is specifically focused on that. And so because of that, I think it was quite complimentary and one of the reasons why these organizations were so supportive and engaged.
It is true. I mean, now that I think about when we started the program at Stanford, it was really for venture-backed boards. So if you're a VC, if you're a CEO of a company or management, or an independent director, right? And here it's like only independent directors, which is a subset of the board and a very important one. Can you talk a little bit about the number of applications, the interest of the program? I mean, I think this is remarkable, but maybe just so some of the listeners can understand the scope and interest in this.
Yeah, sure. So 2 months ago, we put out a call for applications to the program. And we asked for, as I mentioned, executives and other leaders from communities underrepresented in Silicon Valley to apply. We received close to 500 applicants. The quality of the applicant pool was just amazing. My goal was to hopefully have 50 individuals that I thought were more or less board ready. We ended up with 80 in the program, and it just was unable to narrow it down any further. And just, I mean, these were folks, you know, we had the former CFO of FedEx, the former CEO of Glass Lewis, the head of policy and regulatory at Bain Crypto, like just an incredible, I mean, these folks, as you were there, I mean, I think any venture-backed startup would be lucky to have someone like this engaged in their board and leadership. So it was really, for me, that was one of the highlights.
No, for sure. And there was a lot of energy. It was a great crowd, very knowledgeable. And both on the faculty side and the participants and the partners, I mean, it was really remarkable. A few takeaways. There was a lot of focus on fiduciary duties, on the dual fiduciary duties as well. What happens when you have conflicts of interest, which is a very common thing in Silicon Valley, right? It's a small network. And typically, the boards have overly representation from investors. And because there's so few independent directors, they're typically conflicted. And those nuances were very well explained. And the problem is sometimes when you are an independent director, you may be put in the hot seat, right? And people don't, if you don't understand venture, if you don't understand how deals work, and suddenly you have to think about a term sheet and think about how to do this when it's the investors and the founders or the CEOs that have all the information, you have less information available and you have to make the decision. It's very hard. And I think particularly in this time in the economy where we may see down rounds, recaps, fire sales. I mean, now there's more than usual, a lot of risk for independent directors, which is, I think, something that we highlighted in the program and people, I don't think, realized. Can you comment on what were your takeaways maybe on this topic or others?
Yeah. Well, maybe let me provide an example. You know, let's say, Evan, you're starting a company or you start a company and you know, you raise $10 million in venture finance. A few things are going to happen, right? You're going to have to appoint, let's say you'll probably appoint two directors from these VC funds to your board, and then maybe the other directors will be you and a co-founder of your business. So you and your co-founder are the common stock directors, and because probably the two of you hold the majority of the common stock, whereas your VCs represent the preferred stock investors. Now, the VCs, via their $10 million investment, they're likely going to have a liquidation preference, which you know usually breaks down to if we sell this company, they can either take their $10 million back if it's a standard liquidation preference, or they can convert to common stock and take their percentage ownership, which would they would do if you sell the company for a lot of money. But let's say things aren't going that well and you end up selling your company for $10 million. Well, what's going to happen? You know, the VC folks on your board may say like, you know, this is better than nothing. You know, Evan's done. He's not going to run this company anymore. And we'll at least get our money back here. Well, one problem initially is, you know, you and your co-founder, there's going to be no money left for you. So why would you vote for this deal? And so maybe you negotiate with a buyer, a management carve out, which says we're going to take $1 million. So your VCs are only going to lose a little bit money, or maybe the buyer kicks in a little bit more money and we're going to give that to management. But at the end of the day, the common stockholders, and that incentivizes you to vote for the deal. And again, you control a majority of the common stock, but everyone else is left with nothing. And so ultimately, and you know, that may result in litigation. And so what do you do there? You know, that's a tough one, but these are the types of situations that, you know, exist in Silicon Valley and may be more common in this economic environment.
Yeah, I mean, that is the scenario. And you just painted a picture where there were no independent directors, right? But technically, if you had an independent director, you and I don't make the decision. You and I have to put that decision to the independent director. Why? Because the preferred have a conflict. They have a liquidation preference. I have a buyout clause. I have a conflict. I get more than the common, right? So this is why the independent director is in the hot seat. Is this deal fair? Is $10 million really what the company's worth now? Are there other alternatives? Did we go out and seek other money? And people, look, I mean, Adam, I have to say, I've been involved in litigation where this is exactly the question. We depose directors. And what is, I guess, not surprising to me at this stage is when we ask directors, did you understand what you had to do? Did you understand your fiduciary duties? To whom you owe your duties? 100% of the time, on the record, on camera, under oath, they are not able to tell what is their fiduciary duty. It's incredible. Yeah. These are sophisticated people in Silicon Valley who cannot abide by the standards that Delaware law has established. And so that's the only caveat, is that I think that a lot of people want to be on boards because it looks good on their resume, because it's a stepping stone to a public company. But if they don't understand what situation they're put in, it's very complicated. And maybe they have liability, which is personal liability, because the VCs have their own DNO. And so and that was one of my takeaways, is be very careful in what company you're getting into. Understand who the investors are, understand the company. And you should understand how venture works, because this is very unlike a public company.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And I would say, I mean, it's not only the folks that do serve as the independent directors that often don't really understand their duties or venture. Right. It's often the founders and the VCs that serve 100%. On boards. And And hopefully the folks that go through our program do understand this. And I said at the program, it is maybe actually more important for the founders and the VCs to be watching this, and hopefully they will. But yeah, Evan, in that situation, let's say there were independent directors, and you know, they would have to weigh, you know, in this situation, there's a conflict between the preferred investors and the common investors. Right. And one of the takeaways from the program was, you know, all things being equal, you know, the courts will push towards the common director. So in this situation, you know, hopefully an independent director could look at this, and if they were able to determine and vote, you know, against this deal, that, you know, I think we would understand that. Now, let's say there were independent directors and they did not, you know, they sided and they agreed with the founders and the VCs to sell the company. Well, then a court would probably dig into this question of independence. And that's where, you know, a lot of independent directors have gotten into trouble. And I don't want to say, I don't think personal trouble. I don't think there's examples of, you know, personal liabilities on behalf of these independent directors in these cases. But, you know, I think it just increases the likelihood that a court won't uphold the board's decision.
Some lessons, I think, what's important to say is that all of this can be cleansed, right? You can have a process that is fair, right? You can have a special committee. You can do the right thing. I mean, you have to live with conflicts. That's not, you know, a bad thing per se, but if you do the right thing, then it's fine. You can do a carve-out, right? The problem is people don't do this. And so if you are an independent director, you need to be really thoughtful about how the decision was made, have the right information, be advised, and then the court will not second guess you in that situation, right? And it's true that, and I think we spent a lot of time explaining that in Delaware, they are looking more and more deeply into the social ties, the fact that you may own things with others. There is a line of research out there that says most cases, independent directors will side with the preferred investors, with VCs, because that's the money, right? The fact that they may place you in another board and another company, you know, people tend to not go against money and capital, and that's very hard. And that's the reality of how society operates, and it makes it hard to find independent directors. And I think it's something that people don't realize, that, you know, if your kids go to school together and you actually spend holidays together, well, maybe it's hard for you to make a decision. And I think personally that you have to be very courageous to be an independent director in a situation like that, right? Because you have to have this independence of thought, and that's hard.
Yeah, I agree. I guess, you know, some background here. I think we kicked off this program with our law professors, and they talked about these fiduciary duties, and they talked about some of the court cases. We also had a litigator. And, you know, I think some of our folks were scared away, and certainly it's a great responsibility. I don't know if I'd want to serve as an independent director on a venture-backed board. I, you know, would be more interested in serving on public company boards because of the, you know, I think the governance guidelines are more clear, but it's, you know, there's a need amongst venture-backed companies. You know, I wanted to make the distinction. It's not that if you join a board as an independent director and you are friendly and go on social outings with the other directors, then you're going to end up in jail. Like, yeah, that's the extreme. Like, that's not going to happen. It's just, I think the idea here is that you know, independence is something that you should take seriously. And if you are involved in a conflicted transaction and you support one side of that, and then it turns out that you have these connections, well, it may not be upheld. I don't think there's I am less aware of if there's examples of independent directors specifically being held liable beyond their insurance. I know other directors have had, but I've not done an exhaustive search of that. But even then, it would be quite rare. But you're absolutely right that it is something that you know, all board members should take seriously. And I think, you know, the startups and their leadership should really think about and invest in. And governance is always important. And then, you know, I think more important, and, you know, tougher macroeconomic climates, which we seem to be headed into.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that I always tell people is the odds of you being liable out of pocket is almost 0%. I mean, literally 0%. However, if you're sued, It's not pleasant to be deposed and to be involved, and your name will be up there in a newspaper. I mean, reputation matters a lot, and your name is critical. So I think those are the lessons. And maybe it's true that the first day you had every single law professor who writes and research about this topic kind of give these warnings. You had litigators. It's a little bit like if you ask a hairdresser whether you need a haircut, right? Yeah, of course you need one, right? The litigator is going to always go that direction. But those are lessons that I think people who went to the program kind of, oh, okay, I get it, right?
Yeah.
And there are lessons there that actually you got to side with the common shareholders, which is something that I think Professor Abe Cable wrote this fantastic paper that went asking lawyers in Silicon Valley, corporate lawyers, if they advised clients on trade-offs, and there's no agreement on that. So imagine if the corporate lawyers don't actually give the advice that Delaware wants, of course, directors are confused about it. And the other side of it is maybe a small percentage of cases will be litigated, right? So it's still very hard to get there, but it's just that we've gone through 10, 15 years of a bull market where the odds were very small. And now it just happens that that liability or those conflicts are going to be more prevalent. So maybe there's a higher chance, still small, but a little bit higher than, the bull market.
Yeah. And I think just the existence of having an independent director or directors on your board is it lowers the risk to the corporation, right? Because in a lot of these, in Trados, they had an independent director. And in a lot of Silicon Valley companies, there is no independent director or directors. And so, I think that's a change that the industry needs to get behind. I think, the VC community has a responsibility to think about this. And we are seeing people advocate for that. Brad Feld, who spoke in the program, has been a big proponent of startups as early as they're following their first round of venture financing, adding independent directors. So I'm hoping we're seeing a sea change, because I think from a governance perspective, it makes a lot of sense. And it's also a great opportunity to bring diversity into your boardroom. I mean, just by definition, the community that is qualified to serve as independent directors is diverse to the Silicon Valley community, which is highly insular and comes largely from Berkeley and Stanford. So I think it's a win-win.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big lesson as well. And that was a lesson for me about 15 years ago, where you realize that diversity on public boards was mostly driven by independent directors. And because the composition of Silicon Valley startup boards didn't have independent directors, most of the directors were either VCs or founders. And if you looked at the percentage of partners of VC firms, it was like 6% women, right? It was super low. Founders were like 10%. It's gone up, but it's much harder to seek diversity in those ranks. And it's easier to just pull in independent directors who exist and are great out there. But you mentioned the independent director in Trados. One caveat, that independent director was supposed to be independent, but the court said he was a CEO of two portfolio companies of the VC firm and, was an LP in the fund and had this relationship that the court said, well, actually, you probably will side with the VC. You may think you're independent, but you may not be.
And that's my goal with this program quickly. I think that's a really important point, Evan, because historically, when independent directors have been appointed, it usually goes something like this. Maybe the founder decides it's time to appoint a mutual director. Maybe it's pre-IPO, so eventually you'll need to have one. And then usually the founder will ask the VC, do you know anyone? And then it will be a buddy, a friend. And often those folks, won't kind of survive, a court scrutiny on the independence question, which happened in Trados. And so my goal with this program is that there is this body of organizations and universities, and VCs were not included in this process, that are basically selecting, training, certifying folks to serve as independent directors, because I think, again, just by how we're doing this, you won't see as much of that overlap. I think even just a small number of the folks in our initial cohort were even local to Silicon Valley. So I think that's an important point. And my goal with this is that we create a kind of constant supply of folks that just by definition are more independent than what is usually sourced in Silicon Valley.
No, and I agree. And that is totally a great way. I mean, you would think there's always been a legal push from Delaware to increase the number of independent directors. Yeah. I mean, if you read these opinions, they always say Silicon Valley is a den of conflicts. And there are reasons why that hasn't, you know, evolved. But I think because of social, because of how the economy is going, I think we may see more of this. And one thing we should say we haven't really talked about is the role of directors, really, if you think about it, is like twofold. On the one end, you want an advisory role, somebody who has experience, somebody who can help the company expand. But on the other hand, there's also an oversight role, right? And so there is kind of these tensions around the role of the director. And sometimes it's actually when things are not going great where this is scrutinized. And of course, we lawyers, so we're putting much more attention. I'm sure business schools don't even talk about this, right? Because it's kind of, well, you know, who cares, right? That's just the lawyers. So what other components did you add in the teaching schedule? I mean, other than this liability, what else did you think was important for them to get in creating this in 2 days?
Well, I will say, Evan, to your last point, I also think that independent directors can serve an important advisory role because just by nature of them being outsiders or having a different perspective. And if I think about some of the higher profile struggles that Silicon Valley has had, like if you think about the Ubers of the world, which had serious, you know, regulatory challenges, like having, you know, we had, for example, one of the participants in our program this week was the former head of CFIUS, or the Committee on the Foreign Investment in the U.S. And like having a former regulator on your board and advising and helping, like even in good times, I think can be really helpful and interesting. And those folks just aren't that prevalent in Silicon Valley. So I think in addition to kind of on the downside, providing some legal protection to Silicon Valley corporations, I also think on the advising side, independent directors can play a really important role.
Let me just be clear. What I meant is, and I think the value of an independent director is probably 85% on the advisory side.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And 15% on the... I didn't mean that you need him for legal protection. In fact, I think most of the value is, you know, imagine you and I start a company. We're not going to bring an independent director just because, hey, you're independent. Yeah. We're going to bring because that person is going to help us build a company, right? So that's why I think in business schools, they don't really care about this because it's really about the value you bring to the company. Yeah. And so that's something important. And I just want to clarify. You know, finally, I think this program is going to be more and more important as private companies stay private for longer, right? We have gone through these scenarios where for the last 10 years, there was this environment where investors said, you know, stay private for longer. You could raise money. You had these crossover funds, sovereign wealth funds, you know, hedge funds, mutual funds. And in the pandemic, suddenly all these companies were going public, right? And it was great. Now the IPO market or SPAC market is kind of shut down again. But if you look at the numbers, the private markets have become much bigger. So I do believe, and I've always believed, that governance of private companies in the big picture is under-researched, underdeveloped, and needs much more attention. Like the fact that we're talking about the value of independent directors in private companies is kind of surprising, right? You know, how do you think about the surge of private markets, of unicorns? I mean, do you think we're going to have more regulation? There's a lot of questions from the SEC. One of the commissioners was saying that, hey, you know, we shouldn't allow these because it turns out, by the way, that another caveat, another side of this is that we have very founder empowered boards where suddenly you have founders who keep control and it's not the investors who have control, but it's the founder. And of course, we flooded with TV series, books, you know, WeWork, Theranos, all of this that shows you one aspect of bad governance. But what can you tell us about that side of private markets?
It's tough, right? And I think this is going to be the challenge with this program. Even as private markets grow and become more prevalent, a lot of the, for better or worse, a lot of the movement around independent directors and other governance issues are driven by the public markets, NASDAQ and others. I think the SEC and other regulators have been less focused on private markets, and maybe that will change. It's not clear to me like exactly what form that would take. I still think in the short term, we still rely on the industry itself, founders, VCs kind of saying, oh, this is good, this is important, this is something that we need. And, you know, we're going to be working on that. You know, the next step of the program is, you know, we're going to be going kind of doing a roadshow and meeting with various VC funds to make them aware of this kind of pipeline of talent of independent directors. But I still think there's a disconnect, and it's not super clear to me how it will be bridged. But for better or worse, I still think success in this initiative and success in improving governance in Silicon Valley requires those that have the power now to kind of wake up and say, this is good for us. This is something we want.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What were your takeaways? This program just happened this week. It's fresh in your mind. What are your takeaways?
Yeah, my first takeaway, I kept thinking, you know, this is great, but I wish we had more non-independent directors listening to these conversations. And these are communities that are hard to reach, but we'll work on that. That's something I want to do. I want to provide training and resources. And I know this is something you did at Stanford, right? Stanford obviously has that incredible Directors College. And I know for a few years, you had the Directors College for venture-backed companies. Mm-hmm. And I think there needs to be more education, not just for independent directors, but all directors in venture-backed private companies. So that was a big takeaway of something I felt is still missing. I think we need that. Number two, I just, you know, how important, you know, we've worked in Silicon Valley. I've been here, you know, for 15 years now, and just how nice it is to spend time with, you know, leaders, executives from outside of Silicon Valley. It's just
so
really
refreshing.
Yeah, yeah, there we go. And just the perspectives. And I just, that it was so helpful for me, and I'm an academic. I just can only imagine how helpful it would be for, you know, practitioners, executives, leaders in Silicon Valley to do the same thing. So those were the, in addition to the excellent takeaways you've mentioned on this podcast, I think those were two big ones for me.
Those are great. And I do share the same feeling. And it's so refreshing to talk to people from different places and from outside and have different views. And a lot of people also on the crypto side. And I had some fun conversations over drinks with some of the people there. Let me ask you a question for those that are interested in a program. Where can they apply? When is the next program? I'm sure now the word of mouth is going to be big. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the program lives on the website is independent.venturecapitaluniversity.com. We just completed our first cohort of training. There's a lot of interest in running additional cohorts. I do want to see a bit of traction on the placement side of things before we, you know, open it up to more individuals. So I would anticipate in 2023. Hopefully hosted by one of our other academic partners, maybe Hastings. And so that's kind of my thinking of where this will go. But over the next few months, we're really going to be focused on helping to place the 80 individuals who participated in our inaugural cohort.
Let's talk about that, because it's not only a program where you attend for a couple days, but it's really a network that you're building that has more components. And maybe talk about that side, which makes it very special, I would say.
Yeah. So we're doing a few things there on the placement side of things. We are going to be making some recommendations to the National Venture Capital Association on including some optional language in their model legal documents that would actually make it easier for startup boards to appoint independent directors in connection with financings. I am working now on a kind of sign-on pledge letter that we're going to ask Silicon Valley VCs to join and to basically commit to joining this call for governance and placement, increased utilization of the independent director seat, you know, kind of create some awareness of what we're doing and get folks on record for, you know, supporting the appointment of independent directors. And then, you know, specifically for these 80 folks that just went through our program, we are going to spend some time basically helping them work on their board bios, their LinkedIn profiles. We are organizing them by functional industry expertise. And then we're going to be visiting with large VC funds and basically saying, you know, hey, you've got a SaaS portfolio. Here's 10 folks with SaaS expertise. So you have a life sciences fund. Here's 12 people who went through our program who are all former life science executives, our current life science executives. And so that's kind of what we'll be doing over the next few months.
Fantastic. Adam, let me personally and publicly congratulate you for this effort. I think it was a great program. I think it's not a standalone program. It's a long-term project with a lot of top-level partners, top-level universities, and great participants. And I can only see good things coming out of it. So I want to thank you. And I want to say that you did an amazing job. And I'm very happy to have been involved. And it was great. And I can only see it grow.
Well, Evan, thank you. Again, I'll say, you know, this would not have been possible with you really laid the groundwork at Stanford. And so you've been thinking about this for years now. And so I'm proud to have you involved and to kind of build upon what you've started. So thanks for that. And thanks for having me on this excellent podcast.
Okay. But I will still give you the rapid fire questions. You're not going to escape.
Oh, I thought praise would get me out of those. But let's go.
All right. What are the 1, 2, 3 books that have greatly influenced your life?
My venture career, I would say Venture Deals and Secrets of Sound Hill Road, which I had the opportunity to review and provide edits on a early copy. And then beyond that, I would say, I'll go with those two for now and think about a personal one.
Okay. Who are your mentors and what did you learn from them?
Yes, you know, I will say on this, certainly you've been one in this program. Beyond that, another person that was participating in this, Afraf Sharipour at Davis, has just done really incredible work around, she's a kind of traditional M&A law professor, but has done really incredible work looking at representation in venture capital and legal deals. And that's really been inspirational in thinking about a lot of the angles there. And so I'll go with those two.
All right. Are there any quotes you think of often or live your life by?
You know, this comes from one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s speeches, but this idea of you don't have to see the whole staircase to take the first step. And when creating change, both when I was on the nonprofit, social justice, human rights part of things, and then even in my academic work, kind of always trying to keep momentum, move things forward, and don't always, I don't think you always have to think things through to make change. And, you know, that's certainly an approach I've taken with this program. You know, it's not fully thought out and maybe never will be, but I think it's important to have some forward movement and momentum.
No, I love it. And I agree. You know, that first step is critical. What is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
You know, I force myself to create, I don't know if this is unusual, but I do, you know, I have a 40-minute walk to work, and I'm fortunate to do that. And I, you know, could certainly take the bus, which I sometimes do, drive, which I try to avoid. But I find that those 40 minutes, that I actually think having there's a sweet spot with your commute where if you can utilize it and really use that time to kind of think and reflect on your day and what you're, it's like really, for me, when I'm at my most creative. So I actually find, you know, I've worked where I've lived like 5 minutes, you know, and that was, you know, nice, but I lost that time. So I actually think being strategic about your, you know, commute, and then you just more broadly owning your downtime. If you're, you know, your plane's delayed, like it's really easy to get frustrated, which I often do. But if you can kind of shift your thinking and, hey, this is downtime that I didn't think I would have, and I'm going to do, you know, I'm going to rest, read this book. I don't know. That's something that's made me a lot happier in my life by trying. And it's not always easy to do, but trying to kind of lean into the downtime.
Interesting. And so when you walk, do you not listen to a podcast, not listen to music? You actually spend time by yourself? Like, I'm interested in that.
Yeah, I try. So sometimes I'll listen to certain podcasts that I don't feel that actually I can kind of tune out. I do like having background noise, but you know, there's certain podcasts that, you know, like this one, I probably want to listen to closely, but you know, certain podcasts, maybe sports related ones that I don't, it's easy for me to tune out and I can kind of get lost in my thoughts.
Interesting. Finally, which living person do you most admire?
You know, we just had a baby recently, so I'm going to say my spouse, who you know, for me, I love being a father, but childcare, I mean, it's exhausting. If I had the opportunity to be a stay-at-home parent, I think I would choose work over that. And for me, any stay-at-home parent are just heroes. They have the most emotionally and physically demanding jobs ever. But my wife, who works, and you know, I didn't have to go through childbirth and that, and so I just, I think my role as a parent is challenging, and you know, just exponentially more so for her. So just based off of recent experience, and I would say that.
Okay, Adam. Again, thank you very much. This was great. Very excited about what's coming next. I'm energized by the program, which is a really important thing when you go to a program and feel that. So thank you very much. We will, I'm sure, talk soon, but congrats again, and thank you for taking the time.
Thanks, Evan. This was fun.
Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can just find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com.